Good afternoon. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama gave a speech in Illinois last hour about the economy. In it, he outlined some of the challenges faced in the new economy, which we'll talk about this hour.
Even though our businesses are creating new jobs and have broken record profits, nearly all the income gains of the past 10 years have continued to flow to the top 1%. The average CEO has gotten a raise of nearly 40% since 2009. The average American earns less than he or she did in 1999. Companies continue to hold back on hiring those who've been out of work for some time. Today, more students are earning their degree, but soaring costs saddle them with unsustainable debt.
Well, our guest this hour wrote an article that purports that our economy is more dysfunctional than ever, and he laid out eight reasons why in a recent article at Alternet.com. Our guest is Stephen Rosenfeld. He covers democracy issues for Alternet and is the author of Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. Stephen, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, could you give us a little bit of background on your article? It's actually based on, was it a focus group?
Yeah, it was based on a series of focus groups in Florida and Ohio that was done by a polling firm that's generally been associated with Democrats, Greenberg Quinlan Rossner from Washington. And what they did was they went to Florida and they convened two groups with young college women, women under 30, and Latino voters, and then they went to Ohio and they convened a couple of groups with what they describe as white working class voters, and those were of like they weren't just people under age 30. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that they basically found that the president's quote just said that the so-called economic recovery really isn't working for them or isn't touching their lives, and when they kind of drilled into, you know, what they were feeling and what they were thinking, there's a lot of self-sacrifice going on out there. There's more fear than hope. People have lower and lower expectations for themselves and their families. The cost of necessities keeps going up. There's no escape from debt and loans, and that economic inequality is basically a fact of life they have to live with, and the political system is unresponsive. And this is all going on despite, on NPR, the cheery reports on Marketplace of the Dow hitting new heights and, you know, the president saying the recovery is going on and on and on. So it's really a mood of, you know, of fear and diminished expectations, not hope. We can get into it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
But the thing about it that's most notable and what I found was the reason I was writing about it was, you know, it really signals there's a structural shift in the economy that really transcends this notion that people somehow are to blame individually, which you hear all the time from the libertarians and the right-wingers and the people who are lucky enough to have high-paying jobs. They often say, well, if you just worked a little harder, you know, you would be a little bit better off. Well, this really belies that. It suggests that people are really working hard, and they're not better off. And there are reasons, all kinds of reasons for it, and there are all kinds of symptoms in the day-to-day way that people sort of just try to get by. And that's what was particularly striking and I thought was newsworthy.
Well, I'm wondering, though, what standards are used to gauge whether this new economy is indeed the most dysfunctional ever? Is it different from the Great Depression, for example?
Well, headline writers these days write headlines to grab eyeballs. But I think that, you know, what's really different today compared to the Great Depression is that, you know, there's a whole, since then, of course, there's been a, you know, many government social safety nets have been put in place. Those nets are under attack. They're also in the private sector. You know, the whole pension system has all but gone away. And, you know, it's not as if there's, it's a little bit apples and oranges in some respects, mm-hmm. because where people are today, it seems like, well, it's, you know, most people aren't, you know, it's just hard to make that exact comparison. You know, it's fair enough. The Great Depression was terrible. There were no safety nets. People were thrown out of work. They didn't have work for years. But they also didn't live with a lot of, you know, conveniences and things that we take for granted today, you know, in terms of healthcare, medicine, communications, you know, retirement security. So it seems like relative to the post-war period, things are rougher.
Well, let's break apart these eight reasons for a dysfunctional economy. You started out by outlining that I'll just read the little subtitle. It's not my economic recovery. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that, you know, we hear news all the time about the stock market going back up and the increase in home values or the technology sector is booming. And those are all staples of mainstream media content. But people were saying in these focus groups that this just does not describe their world. You know, home prices might be going up, but they can't buy a home or they can't move out of a home or they don't really have much savings anyway. And people said that their personal finances were very rocky and very frail. And people were afraid of losing their homes. Others said that, you know, going back a half dozen years, they were making twice the income they're making now. Others said that, you know, I don't see, you know, my home values in my neighborhood going up. You know, so that's what I mean when I say it's not my economic recovery.
Mm-hmm. So the mood is fear, not hope.
Yeah, so, you know, here again, you know, let me just read some of the quotes, because these, you know, I thought what was really remarkable about this particular report by these pollsters was that it contained all quotes. And people say that they're just living on this economic edge where, quote, you know, where, you know, fear, worry, and caution are pervasive. You know, people say, I can't afford to lose right now. People say, I'm being conservative. It's starting to balance out a little bit, but we never know. It's a roller coaster, someone says. People say it's scary. Some people are afraid. People say, well, my friends and family, they're okay, but they're really struggling. And if something bad happens, you know, what are they going to do? So that's why, you know, the headline on that, the mood is fear, not hope, is what we wrote.
What do you think the long-term effects of that might be? For example, I'm thinking back to maybe our grandparents' generation that lived through the Great Depression, and they turned out to be a hardy and frugal group. Do you think that will, in essence, happen again with the people who are living through the Great Recession?
Well, that's a great question, and it's very interesting you say that, because another trend that was spotted amid all this was that people are saying that self-sacrifice has become routine. You know, they talk about living paycheck to paycheck. They talk about looking for sales and pinching pennies. People talk about moving their parents back in with them. It's not just people going who are like college graduates who can't find jobs staying with their parents. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about self-sacrifice so that, you know, people can provide for their kids. I think that, you know, that's very much in step, you know, with the you know, that frugality that you talked about. But what's really kind of telling about this is that, you know, okay, I was born in the late 50s, and people were raised with this notion that, you know, every generation will do a little bit better than the one that preceded it. But these days, there seem to be lower and lower expectations. Now, that's notable. And you know, and it's grounded in things like, okay, there are a lot of jobs out there, but what are they paying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're, you know, and what are the benefits? And then compared to the costs of, you know, healthcare, even with Obamacare, you know, gas, food, other things, college loan rates, you know, these really big expense, big ticket items, they seem to just be going only one way, and that's up. So I think when you say, you know, is this going to be a more frugal generation? Well, get back to those, you know, sturdy, hardy, you know, laudable values. I think people are trying to live that way. You know, not going out there and you know, there is a class of people that goes out and buy Lexuses and buys new fancy sports cars and everything, but that's not who this is really talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess taking that a step further, I was wondering more about in the long term. I know for now we're doing it now, but let's say the economy really does take a turn for the better in the next couple of years and we start to feel more secure financially. Do you think that our habits will then change back to maybe, say, the era of extravagance that we lived through in the 90s, or do you think we're going to kind of hang on to our wallets a bit tighter?
Gosh, it's really, really hard to say. It's hard to predict. I just can't really say. I mean, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and mm-hmm. it's, you know, we have a giant tech bubble going on, and people who are making a lot of money are spending a lot of money, and it's causing a lot of strange dislocations. Like, you know, rents here have gone up by, you know, 30, 40, 50%. Housing prices are just crazy. People can't afford to live here who are not part of that giant bubble. Those in the bubble are doing splendidly. You see all kinds of new sports cars and things like that. So, and it's young, and those tend to be younger people. So, you know, it's really hard to generalize. It's really hard to say. But, you know, the long-term economic prospects for middle-class America, according to places like the Wall Street Journal and their columnists and their analysts, are not very good. Because as the world's economy becomes more globally integrated, as other nations become wealthier, and as they have emerging middle classes, you know, that creates downward pressure on lots of jobs and wages here. And I'm not just talking about manufacturing. You know, it's you know, call customer service, and you're talking to somebody overseas who's college educated. You know, as you know, and their colleges cost a lot less than ours do here. And so, you know, it's, I don't know that we're really headed to, you know, great new heights. It seems like, you know, the economy has these, structure of it has really big, you know, it's distorted in a lot of ways. And look, the New York Times just had a piece out. It was a front page story a day or two ago that said, depending where you live in a city and how, whether or not you're exposed to wealthier people really will determine your economic prospects.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they're talking about major American cities. And, you know, and there the main point is if you are sort of ghettoized, if you're stuck in, you know, somewhere in whatever, however you would characterize the rungs, you know, in the middle class, you know, you're not, the chances are more likely than not that you're not going to be able to grab up and, you know, yank yourself up to a higher ladder. Maybe you don't have the connections. Maybe you don't have the education. Maybe you don't have the money for school. It's sort of like the Obama quote you just played. Why is it that some people, you know, are making less or the same as they were, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and others are making a lot more?
Mm-hmm. I'll just go to a break real quick, and then we will invite some callers into our discussion here. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and Stephen Rosenfeld is our guest. He covers democracy issues for Alternet and is the author of Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide for Voting. His recent article, 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever, can be found at Alternet and Salon.com. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you find that the economy is more dysfunctional than ever? Are you feeling the effects that we've been talking about, cutting corners? Are you finding that student loan debt, for example, is crippling your ability to keep up with the cost of living? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back with Stephen right after this. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Stephen Rosenfeld. He covers democracy issues for Alternet and is the author of Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. His recent article, 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever, can be found at Alternet and Salon.com. Stephen, we were talking about some of these pillars of the new new economy, and the general mood among consumers being fear, not hope. I'm wondering what it will take to restore confidence in consumers and investors once again.
Well, it's really interesting. That was not asked in the materials that I read from these focus groups, but the answer is absolutely implicit in everything that they expressed their worries about. Well, if people made a little more money and didn't feel the pressure, if they felt there was an escape from debt and loans, if they felt that economic inequality was less commonplace and less predetermined, not more predetermined, if they thought the political system was more responsive, if they thought the prices or the cost of necessities wouldn't always just keep going up, up, and up, if they felt they didn't have to lower their expectations, if they mm-hmm. felt that, you know, self-sacrifice was healthy, but okay, let's live a little. It's everything they said, you know, sort of implies that if they got a little bit of a break, you know, then they could breathe easier and live easier, but not necessarily, you know, live, you know, more lushly or greedily, but just a little easier.
Well, while national employment rates are generally falling, people are not terribly optimistic about the job market, but can they be at least for the prospect of finding part-time work?
Well, yeah, but, you know, here's the thing that people talked about with jobs, and it's really interesting. People are saying, yes, there are jobs out there, but look at what they are and look at what they pay. And in terms of, you know, the benefits, the biggest point they made is that they're not being paid living wages in contrast to the cost of everything else. And when they talk about the cost of everything else, they're really talking about, you know, the big ticket items, which is, you know, it's housing, it's health care, it's credit, including college loans, and, you know, and then food and gas and, you know, and you know, utilities. There's not much left for anything else. So they say, yeah, there are a lot of jobs out there in housekeeping. There are a lot of jobs in the service sector. But, you know, and then the question is, okay, well, we hear there are a lot of sales jobs out there, but well, what is the structure of those jobs? What's their pay scale? What, you know, do they come with benefits? You know, or so that's the kind of thing when you get to the next level that they basically just say, yeah, there are jobs, but most of the jobs can't really support them or their families, and their bottom line point is they're not being particularly greedy.
Do we know if there's any research along these lines with regards to prospective college students and whether they're reconsidering a college education given the cost of education relative to the job market?
Well, I can't really tell you about research, but I can tell you about anecdotal stuff that we've come across and have run on Alternet. You know, you always see these stories about, you know, some computer whiz kid who drops out of college and goes off to, you know, to become the next millionaire in Silicon Valley. And they're celebrated for that. And, you know, and some even move back to Detroit, you know, places like that where they think, hey, you know, there is still a car industry there and they need to have people designing those computers, so let's be part of that. And but primarily, you know, those are exceptions. They're not, you know, the rule. And a lot of people, question what, you know, the value that they get, you know, in college degrees and in graduate degrees. You know, there's a big debate in the amongst lawyers as whether law school is worth the price. So this is anecdotal. I wish I could tell you about, mm-hmm. you know, studies, but you know, we see articles like this and we run articles like this all the time. And quite frankly, I think it scares me because when I think about my daughter who's in high school, I think, my God, you know, she has got to, like, not just get a college degree, but she's got to get some kind of a graduate level of training in a field that's not going to be, you know, outsourced and sent overseas.
Right.
And who knows if that, you know, she'll stay in school that long. So, you know, but that's completely anecdotal. That's not scientific. That's just what we observe.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there might be an institutional change over time then with regards to the structure of higher education and the cost of it?
Well, we're seeing some really weird things in that regard. You know, in some states, the Republican governors are saying we need to force, you know, change the priorities in the state university system. This is Florida, for example, and make it more, you know, jobs oriented and basically not fund the humanities. You know, a lot of colleges and universities are moving to online education, and I think the jury is really out as to whether that's going to be, you know, it certainly is a cost saver, but in terms of, you know, the college and education experience that I remember is being it's not being stuck in your room behind a computer, but it's being with other people. And, you know, and half of the opportunities that come in life from going through college come because you knew people, they introduce you, and this and that, and that's missing in online education. So here again, I don't really know, except that, you know, we run plenty of stories that suggest that it's a great cost saver, and a lot of people are making a lot of money on it, but it's not necessarily a guarantee to much of anything. I know with online education, the graduation rates are terrible. I know the banks love it because they lend money, you know, at rates that are hard to pay back. So I don't know what to tell you there, really.
Our guest is Stephen Rosenfeld. He covers democracy issues for Alternet, and his recent article is 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever. Let's take some phone calls. We've got Mike in Castle Rock on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hello. You know, I blame government for this and probably the opening of China and all those think groups back in, you know, the Harvard graduates and Yale that get together back east. They never saw this, what was happening. We're not all created equally, and you need jobs. You need people to turn bolts and people to design the bolts. That's not going to happen. And I agree with everything you said, but I believe also that this is all going to implode. This is simply not sustainable.
Thank you, Mike. And, Stephen, that kind of speaks to one of your pillars as well. The political system is unresponsive.
Well, look, all we have to do is to take a look at today's news, literally today's news. The New York Times front page discusses how the Republicans in Congress are going to trying to defund everything that's a Democratic priority in terms of environment, regulation, labor. You know, the president's out there trying to talk about what can be done for the middle class. They're talking past each other. The summer that usually comes after presidential year is usually sleepy politically, but because of the Obamacare implementation deadline on October 1st, you know, both sides are using that as or being driven by that to ratchet up the fighting. And it's terribly depressing. I mean, you could really say, and I think people make law professors on constitutional law blogs say that our constitutional system is completely broken down. You can't pass things in Congress. The Supreme Court has way too much power. You know, and there's no solution in sight. I tend to agree with the last caller. It's very, very discouraging. And then the corollary is, well, what's the private sector doing? Well, you know, we're a marketing society. We're not creating jobs in a classic, you know, manufacturing or more historic opportunity society manner. So it's discouraging.
Mm-hmm. Well, in his speech today, President Obama also mentioned that he wasn't going to accept political gridlock as a non-resolution to the economy. Let's take a listen to one of his sound bites.
That means whatever executive authority I have to help the middle class, I'll use it. Where I can't act on my own and Congress isn't cooperating, I'll pick up the phone, I'll call CEOs, I'll call philanthropists, I'll call college presidents, I'll call labor leaders, I'll call anybody who can help and enlist them in our efforts.
And Stephen, how likely is that? How effective can one man, the President of the United States, be in this scenario?
I don't know. It would be really nice to see him try and then watch and all be surprised, because the power of the president in domestic affairs has really shrunk in recent years. I'm not talking about executive authority to wage wars overseas. That doesn't even come before Congress's purview. And, you know, it would really be remarkable if there was some level of, if he was successful at some level, because it's not about him. You know, it's about what's happening to our society. You know, the libertarians are sort of winning this latest phase of the culture wars, which means everybody's a little more on their own and has no one to blame but themselves. And not everybody, like your caller said, you know, is you know, is going to be born, you know, into like a millionaire's, you know, home or get, you know, some great six-figure job. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those jobs are not being offered in vast stretches of the country to people. So it's, I don't know. We'll see what he has to say. I think that this president has been it's remarkable how little he's gotten done compared to what he said he was going to try to do, you know, given the intransigence of, you know, of his political opponents. It's just a fact. Again, look at today's New York Times. It's mind-boggling. The Republicans say they're going to shut the government down if a penny goes to Obamacare. You know, they want to cut all these agencies by another, you know, 30, 40, 50%, leaving very little left except roads, cops, and, you know, and the military. I don't know what you say to that.
Yeah. Let's go next to Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank. Frank, are you there?
No. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
I apologize for being on the phone. I'm going to take that.
Okay, Frank. I'm going to put you back on hold until you're ready to go. Let's go next to Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Hi, Jocelyn.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. I agree with everything that what your guest is saying, but I really don't think, unless some miracle happens or some new kind of industry may come up and bring up all votes, as they say, which I don't believe has ever happened. But I believe that and see for a fact that it comes down to exploitation. I've never seen some of the laws pass so quickly with the majority of the Republicans that we have in this state. It's unbelievable. They are trying to dismantle the unions. It's known for a fact that the business world is the least of democratic in all of the society, and the environmental degradation, and then you add overpopulation, automation. I really don't see, you know, and if you even had a gazillion jobs tomorrow, that doesn't mean it's going to alleviate what supports us, and that is what is being done to the earth. If you don't have a healthy earth, we won't matter at all.
Thanks, Jocelyn. So Jocelyn touches on a number of issues there, and many of them, I you know, it sounds like they point to some political issues going on in the state of Wisconsin, which I'm not sure you followed.
Well, no, I actually have followed. We did quite a bit of cover. I actually oversaw our coverage of the Scott Walker recall election. Mm-hmm. And I've written political books about Ohio. I've spent some time in the Midwest and I don't think it's correct to call today's Republicans conservatives. I think you have to call them business libertarians. And, you know, they believe that they believe in making money in any way possible. Rules get in the way, and tough luck for everybody else who's not smart enough to make that the priority. Now, you know, I write for a left of center, you know, news site, and you know, we happen to believe there's a little more to life that matters than just, you know, making money first and foremost. And you know, and then you just break it down even further. The House Appropriation Committee, you know, just passed their version of the environmental budget. It basically guts the EPA. It stops research for climate change. And, you know, this is just stupid stuff from a business standpoint, because from my perspective, you know, friends of mine who are environmental consultants, they say pollution is wasted raw material. It's losing money. So there are opportunities in being cleaner, in being greener. But, you know, the oil industry, they know that the value of their commodity only gets more valuable when it stays in the ground. And, you know, and they're very, very, very powerful. And, you know, so, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And it seems like, well, you know, what can I say? It seems like, you know, these are really big fights where, you know, the reasonable middle ground just, it doesn't really stand a chance. So I don't know, you know, what else to say. But I mean, you look at what's happening in the House Appropriations Committee in Washington today. It's obviously it's a bargaining ploy. Well, they're waiting to the last minute. They're proposing all these draconian cuts. They're hoping that they'll get something equal or greater to the what happened with the sequester, and they're hoping to, you know, destroy Obamacare in the process. Well, you know, how does that really help ordinary people? You know, create new jobs, pay less for health insurance. You know, I just, you know, it becomes an extreme sport, you know, not public service.
Our guest is Stephen Rosenfeld. He covers democracy issues for Alternet and is the author of Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. And his recent article, 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever, can be found at Alternet and Salon.com. I believe we've also linked it to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's go next to Marcus in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was a teenager, I used to watch the news with my dad, and I remember something about when Nixon opened up trade with China, and there was other stuff going on in the news. And my dad said that eventually the middle class in America will be eliminated. And he made it sound like a bad thing. He compared it to Mexico, where there was a lot of elite, and then a lot of people that didn't have wealth at all. And I don't know, have we reached that point? And what does that mean for the future down the road?
What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I think we should ask your guest. Don't you think we are moving towards that point?
Marcus?
You're asking me?
Mm-hmm. What have you seen with manufacturing and, you know, and those kinds of jobs, you know, in your state since the 80s?
Yeah. I feel that he was right. I felt that for many years, you know, So, yeah, and it doesn't look good for the future, does it? I mean, isn't the middle class what drives America, or has it gotten it to be the wealthy country that we are, or powerful?
You know, yes. The answer to that, the simple answer to that is yes, it is. It's small business, not big business. It's people who could afford to own homes. And it's parents who could, you know, have enough spare time so they could, you know, be able to raise kids. I know this sounds, you know, hopelessly, you know, mainstream and conventional, but it's just the truth. And, you know, and we've seen, as you know, you know, we're not seeing more manufacturing jobs being created here with, you know, 21st century technology than we are service industry jobs. Most of the jobs that are being created don't have good benefits. They don't have retirement security. You know, people, you know, let's talk about what happened with Scott Walker and the recall. You know, people used to go into state governments and government jobs because they made less money, but they had, you know, they had secure retirements and decent health care. They had decent benefits. Well, now those benefits are being seen as being excessive, because compared to the way they vanished in the private sector, and it's great wedge politics. Let's, you know, Republicans, let's go after the unions and make them, you know, people angry for the benefits that public sector workers have, because you're not going to get that in a private job. Well, you know, it becomes a fight between people who are on the losing end of an equation, you know, and that large dynamic, that momentum, is not being reversed. We're not seeing the restoration of retirement security. We're not seeing, I mean, even the college loan compromise that just passed last, you know, week, it came out of the Senate. Yeah, so college loan interest rates will be 3.5% for undergraduate and a point higher for graduate or something like that. But they can go up to 8 or 9%. Well, you know, talk about anybody who has an 8 or 9%, you know, home loan. You know, that's a pretty big payment. So the banks win again. So, again, like, you know, this survey that I ended up writing about, these focus groups, people complain about this stuff. They say it makes them uneasy. They say they don't see a way out. And what they say they want is a break, and they don't see it coming. And that's why, we're saying these are signs that the economy, despite the so-called recovery, is still very dysfunctional.
We're talking with Steven Rosenfeld. He is author of Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting, and covers democracy issues for Alternet. And we're talking about his recent article, 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever. We want to hear from you. What do you agree with these statements? Do you agree that our economy is very dysfunctional? And what do you blame for that? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at KDunnShow. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're talking with Steven Rosenfeld. He covers democracy issues for Alternet and is author of Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. We're talking about his recent article, 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Stephen, one of the reasons that our economy is dysfunctional is, according to this focus group that you reported on, is that economic inequality is now a fact of life. And in fact, that people interviewed say that they felt more aware of income equality now. But how do they feel that? How are they aware of it?
Well, they feel that they mentioned very basic things. They said that they were afraid of losing their homes. They said that. Going back a half dozen years, they were making much more money, maybe twice the income they're making now. You know, they just talk about their personal finances as being precarious. It's almost like that cliche of, they can't afford to, like, lose the next paycheck. It's not a cliche. You know, they say things like 2 steps forward, 4 steps back, mm-hmm. things like that.
Well, we've got a call from Renee in Green Bay. Let's talk to Renee. Hi, Renee.
Hi. I'm making less money today than I was in 1999. Due to downsizing, I've had to start over twice at new companies. And I think due to high unemployment, employers have all the power right now to pay lower wages and fewer benefits. But they are forced to do that because so many of our products are made abroad. I think we need to stop companies from going overseas and to limit imports. I think that would really help our economy.
What do you say to that, Stephen?
Well, it's intriguing. Obviously, Americans, they like to buy a lot of cheap stuff made overseas because they're making less money. It's a vicious circle. But, I tend to, mm-hmm. I know most people I know who do not have corporate jobs have really been riding this seesaw. You know, one year they'll make $60,000, the next year they'll make $30,000. And this is in the Bay Area, and cost of living here is high. And it's not any different than these comments that were in these focus groups from people in Florida or people in Ohio. To tell you the truth, I don't like to be so negative about all this stuff and talk about it negatively and sort of editorialize negatively. But it's very... if you just want to be realistic and pragmatic, this economic recovery has really not touched so many slices of society. It hasn't seen the growth of new industries that are generating jobs in across America. Yes, there are pockets of technology and this and that, and everywhere possible, people's assets and information have been, commoditized and marketed and securitized. And, Lord knows, people can't, get penalized if they miss a single payment for anything. The overall, environment is discouraging. And I think Obama knows that. And I think that's why he's out there talking tough today. And, of course, it remains to be seen what can happen.
Let's go next to Greg in Madison. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I could get real specific, but I'll just make a general observation. I'm in my early 60s, and this is definitely not the country I grew up in and started out life in. I just see the top 1 or 2% getting extremely, obscenely wealthy, while the rest are just grabbing, scratching, clawing stay in the middle class, and if you're not in the middle class, you're grabbing, scratching, and clawing just to survive. And at some point, 99% versus 1%, 99% are going to say, that's enough. This is a rigged system, and we've had enough. That's my comment. I could get more specific, but I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Greg. Your thoughts, Stephen?
Well, it's really interesting to look at what's asked the question, what's it going to take? Now, on July 4th, the New York Times, as it always does, prints the Declaration of Independence. And this year, they had a feature where they actually talked about what were some of the personal sacrifices that the signers had to endure after they signed it. Because they put, you know, they put a lot of their personal wealth and property on the line. And I just don't see that happening today. You know, when we have our editorial meetings at Alternet, we don't just talk about the 1%. We sort of raise this question sometimes of, like, how many people are making more than $100,000 or $150,000 nationally? And what percentage of the electorate is it? And it's tens of millions of people. And they are, you know, they are not voting for change. They're voting to preserve, you know, the relative privilege that they have. And I don't know what it's going to take. You know, we take a look at, like, what just happened to the Voting Rights Act by the U.S. Supreme Court and what's not happening with immigration reform in Congress. So, yeah, you will have, you know, certain segments of society, you know, 10% of Americans are African American. It's a slightly larger number for, the whole Latinos. You know, they're mobilized. They're mobilizing around those kinds of, you know, these civil rights issues. And it remains to be seen what will happen. But in terms of, you know, economic reform, structural reform, you know, changing the political system, the campaign finance system, you know, the accountability system, it's not, you know, I've covered these issues for 25 years. Things have only gotten worse. And I tend to agree with, and that's why I said, as I said before, you have these law sites, these law blogs, which I read, you know, these constitutional scholars, they say the Constitution is broken. It didn't envision the gridlock we have today. You know, government is stuck. You know, the tyranny of a small minority holds everybody else hostage, and there's nothing that anybody can do about it. And that's really, like your caller just said, you know, it's not the country some of us, you know, maybe we were fed and we bought this grandiose myth that America is greater than it actually is. But, you know, but we do believe, we were led to believe, you know, in the arc of progress. And some, you know, we look at this, what's happening today in the country, you know, not for the wealth pockets, not for New York City, not mm-hmm. for Silicon Valley, but, you know, a lot of the rest of America. And it's very discouraging.
You mentioned that one of the coping mechanisms in the midst of all this gridlock and the slowing economy is self-sacrifice on an individual level. This is more of a sociological question than an economic one, but I'm wondering if, you know, having grown children live with their parents or having grandchildren live with their grandparents that have three generational households, is that all that bad? I know that it's many people don't consider it ideal.
Well, it's not necessarily all that bad, but because in many ways I was thinking about that in a different way. You know, I was thinking about my father's family, and you know, who was a second generation American, you know, in immigrant. His parents came over from Eastern Europe, you know, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. and that's how they lived. But in general, people are doing that not necessarily because they're choosing to do it. They're doing it because they can't afford not to do it. So it's, you know, so that, you know, life is not perfect, and it's not going to always be easy street for everyone. But when people have to make choices out of, you know, necessity or pressure as opposed to choice, those aren't the best of circumstances. You know, that's not always the clearest thinking.
I'm Cynthia Schuster talking with Stephen Rosenfeld, and we're talking about his article, 8 Reasons Our Economy is More Dysfunctional Than Ever. Let's go next to Dwayne in Wausau. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, hi. I agree with the last few callers, and Greg, I think, said something about, my original point was, you know, follow the money. The driving factor is one of the biggest things is healthcare cost is eaten up so much money. And if you follow everybody's income going toward premiums, going toward copays, I mean, it used to be dentists were reasonable. Now even that's a ton of money. And it used to be your dad would get a pension from the company. Now you have to fund your own pension, college tuition. So back in the 60s and 70s, when I was 10 and your dad had the mortgage payment, that was the biggie. Now it's the healthcare insurance is almost as big as a mortgage for a lot of people if you don't have a company sponsor, you know, or company kicking in. And then, you know, oh, no more pensions. You know, 401, put your own money in or save in a. So any money that had was disposable comparatively back in the day, it's, you know, and then, of course, then you don't have the good, you don't have five factories in nice 100,000 populous job cities. You got maybe one, and the rest are service sector jobs. So it's not the same. It's like the 1% guy said. It's going to be like old England, kings and queens and peasants, and sooner or later, it's going to be way more people that it will, you know, not take it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Dwayne. Stephen, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I tend to agree with that observation. And the whole notion, you know, the whole thing about 401ks and replacing pensions, it has such a devious history. 401ks were created so that the government could try to capture a little bit of the income in bonuses that were given to CEOs already making, you know, these super high salaries. Well, then people on Wall Street realized that we could sell them to companies as an alternative investment vehicle, and they didn't have to fund pensions. And it shifted the responsibility for being responsible and savvy investors from HR departments, where people who were professional investors who spent their days making sure that the investments were good, to individuals who spend their days working other jobs. And as a result, we people are dangled a zillion different things to put their money in, but nobody really knows what they're investing in. And it's just another sign of, you know, we're being forced to be more on our own with more to worry about rather than less.
Would you say that there has been a collective psychological shift over the course of a generation or two, maybe from looking at pensions, for example, as something that that we would deserve versus something that we need to fund ourselves? And do you know at what point that shift took place?
Well, I do know that it's really interesting that one of the cultural legacies of the 1960s wasn't just this, you know, do your own thing, you know, hippie creativity, you know, thing, and that led to the environmental movement and the women's movement and also Greta, the civil rights movement. That do your own thingism also landed on Wall Street. And you know, it used to be in the 60s, on Wall Street in the early 70s, that, you know, executive salaries weren't so high and corporate taxes were much, much higher. But then there came this notion that, you know, like this ultra libertarian, mindset just landed there and really took off. Like, you know, so in the 80s you had all the leverage buyouts, and then you had all the mergers and acquisitions, and, you know, in the 90s. And I remember when I was at NPR in the late 90s covering money and politics, you know, there was never a merger that wasn't cheered, you know, by the economic reporters and by Marketplace, and it was always announced as the next latest and greatest thing. And there were never any follow-up stories on, well, what happened to the closed factories, or very, very few. And we've just gone on and on since then, where this notion that, everyone's out for themselves has really kind of, you know, it's become part of, you know, the collective, you know, our cultural consciousness. And young people, you know, they've you know, they've grown up and, you know, in the last 10 years under, you know, the shadow of Bin Laden and war and college loans. And, you know, it's not, you know, they say constantly in polls that, mm-hmm. you know, they don't think there's going to be any retirement there for them. They, you know, they're trending more libertarian than they ever have before because they realize, well, we're just out for ourselves.
And Stephen, we just have a few seconds left. So what are your parting thoughts here? Are things looking up eventually?
I would like to be optimistic, but right now I think that our economy is not structured to really help the average person, and I wish I didn't have to say that.
Okay. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Cynthia Schuster, and this is the Ideas Network.